So the talk tonight is on empathy and love and compassion as flowers in the garden, you can call them. And I want to start with a small story of where I found myself limited in empathy, love and compassion. It's a small vignette. One of my grandchildren was staying the night and it was a beautiful day together. We had a great afternoon and evening, and then that was it, and I wanted her to go to bed and, you know, finish the day kind of, and she refused to go to bed. And so somehow a bit of irritation, a little bit, enough already. I want to get on with my own things and go to bed. She said, no, I'm not going to bed. And go to bed, you know. And she refused. And I was found myself just in this kind of opposition place. And then she said, and I said, why? The day's over. She said, I'm afraid of the dark there. And all of a sudden, when she said that, my whole resistance to her not wanting to go to bed, you know, collapsed completely. I realized that there's something there I just hadn't seen. And immediately the love and the empathy immediately came, rose up just straight away when I saw that really that was her, her goodness was there, but she was afraid of the dark in the house, part of the house. And the love came back and the empathy came back, and I was sort of totally with her. And it's a story really about how vulnerability, and if we don't understand it, vulnerability can separate us from love and empathy. And also it can invite love and empathy. To be honestly vulnerable, to see the vulnerability of others and of ourselves, will invite us back into love and compassion. And if we don't see it fully, it will separate us from people. It's a limit to the love and compassion, limit to empathy. So I want to start by discussing empathy a little bit, because it puts it in a place of nature. That the practice we're doing is building on what we already have. It's building on who we already are. Even if it's practice, so it seems like as if we are intentional and we are doing something, we're practicing, we're developing something, bhavana, cultivating something, but we're cultivating what already is there. Actually, the whole of the Dharma is that. It's cultivating what already is there. The awakening, even, that we sometimes think of it as out and away. It's the seeds are here. The Buddha nature is here. It's all here, and the empathy is right here as a good example of what we're practicing now. Empathy is something that arrives with birth. The mother and the child are empathic with each other. The child feels the mother. The mother knows exactly what's going on with the child, or more or less. But usually, without words, without explanations, without the baby writing an email, I'm hungry. just straight away, it's clear. Oh, I need khaki. I need this. The whole thing is somehow flowing through feelings with one of another, and these feelings are immediate, and they're the same feelings we have when we look in each other's eyes just for a moment as we're passing, and we know what we're feeling more or less between each other. We know immediately, with a stranger, angry, sad, sick, happy, immediate. It's instant, and we don't even know that we know it. It's just automatic. And you say to someone, oh, you're feeling a bit down, or I see you've had a hard day. It can be a stranger, but you know straight away because of the empathy that's there. It's built in what neurology calls mirror neurons, which are kind of part of the brain that's just immediately responding as a mirror to others. and we just learnt very automatic and very immediate and nothing to do with thinking. And as soon as the mind comes in, then begin all the problems. And the mind comes in with concepts. If you think about it, you lose it. If you think that you should be this or you should be that, or you think about a problem between you and somebody, empathy goes. You think, in my case, with the grandchild, I thought it was time for her to go to bed, you know, empathy gone. As soon as I saw the truth of this moment, empathy came back. So all thinking and concepts and views and opinions about the way things should be, the way the other person should be, everything interferes. And this, by the way, going to go back to it again, but this, by the way, is important for our practice here, because it's non-conceptual practice. It's not about thinking ourselves to love. It's not about concepts of love. It's about, in the silence, just dropping into a place where love is located, in a non-conceptual, immediate space of heart. You can also say heart and belly, actually, and guts. It's there as well. It's right there. We sit here, you know, sitting solid here. It's biological. It's us. It's so under the, and it's immediate, and it doesn't need thinking. And our relationships with others are based on this. We don't know why we fall in love with somebody. It's all under the radar. Tachat ha-radar. It's all in a level of non-concept. You know, as soon as concepts come in, why is it actually that I love this person? So maybe I don't really love this person. They've got habits. They you know, they don't do the washing up. They're not really. Well, underneath it, the love and the relationships are all about underneath the qualities, and this is what we're practicing here. And it's nice, and when you think about courses of silent retreats, it's actually very nice to understand what goes on. In silent retreats, most people at the beginning say it's very artificial not to speak. We're here, all of us together. I mean, you're old students, so you know it. But new students think it's very weird. But we're not speaking. We're all together, and it's so artificial. I have to shut up. I can't speak. I can't connect. It's not right. It's awkward. And then generally, after a few days, they say, "Well, thank goodness I don't need to speak all the time." And also, I feel others in a way which I wouldn't have done if I'm speaking all the time. I feel others. I feel if someone's a bit distressed or a bit uncomfortable, or I feel energy from somebody, or I feel how they're sitting, I feel the way they look at the world, I see from their posture, I see from the way they're walking, how they are. And we notice others on the under level, which is the speaking can actually be a masach, it can be a veil and interfere with that relationship under the empathic feeling of being with. I was once in a train. I'm traveling a lot on Rakevet Israel. That's where I spend quite a lot of time. Teach in Tel Aviv, and I refuse to drive, so I'm on the trains quite a lot. And there was a couple of soldiers chatting away in one of the compartments, one of the bays, and next to them was a woman, and a sort of young middle-aged woman, and they were chatting and so on, and they and she looked, you know, totally Israeli, like one of the chevra style, the way her dress, that she wasn't speaking, and they were saying some rather negative things about Arabs, but not crude, but still kind of in the language, it was it was negative. And they assumed that she wasn't an Arab, obviously, because she was almost part of the conversation. They were chatting openly with her next to, and there, and then one of them took off something and said, "Oh, it needs mending," or something in the uniform. And then she turned to them and said, "I'm an Arab, and I'll mend your thing, whatever it was. I've got needle and cotton, I can mend it for you." And they were, you know, totally, they just didn't know where to lift their head. They were like this. But it made me think that, you know, they were in the realm of empathy. They assumed that everyone was with them. They didn't think about it too much. The minute that she came as an Arab, all the views, all the conditioning, all the concepts, all the differences, all the divisions, and that everything collapsed, and there was no longer any, they couldn't talk. And we can be in real good communication with somebody, and then something comes up, like a view or a memory or a thought or the difference, or maybe or a fear of them or whatever, and immediately the empathy just goes. So it's clearly that, you know, the empathy needs us to be the minimum free from interfering concepts and thoughts and me. The empathy is not really about me. The empathy is happening underneath. And the minute the me comes in, it interferes with empathy and interferes with love. It just stops it. And I talked about this the other day, yesterday or the day before, on about love and resistance. And we really need to come out of our comfort zone of me and what I think I need and what I feel about me and so on. We need to get out of that comfort zone to let other people in. Because if we're locked in our comfort zone, we keep others out. And we have to be a little bit less busy with me and what I think I need and what I want and what is good for me and what I history and my story and my this and what I feel and da 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 da. Get out of that comfort zone to allow the world in, to allow others in. Right, the Buddha, you know, in a way he was alone in the Buddha's castle with his wife and children and so on, but he wasn't satisfied there. So love is always kind of threatened by me, the me, and our ego. We want control. It's like we all know this story of a sweet little baby, and when the sweet little baby grows up to be a rather angry teenage, then the love is questioned, or even worse, the sort of becomes an angry adult. What happened? It's simply that the love was dependent on being a sweet little baby, and as soon as this person started to be an ego, the love was threatened and often destroyed, and relationships in families full of anger and full of distance. And we can almost see that there's a kind of track. The most love is for me, and it always is, and this is fine, because we are also the Buddha said so, the most precious being in the world to us is ourselves, and that's fine, because we are closest to ourselves, and we need to care for ourselves. And that's why also we started with caring here, in the retreat, caring for ourselves. So we love ourselves most. Next circle would be family. Next circle would be friends. Next circle would be loose friends, associates, people we work with, whatever. Next circle would be Aham Shali or whatever, like or my or Adachali or I, you know, identity, which is a big group. The next circle will be everybody else, and don't have to bother with them. And you say, "Niim ircha kodmim." And to my response is, "Where is ircha? It should be the whole world, no?" You know the phrase. It comes from, I think it's a Talmud phrase. Aniim ircha. Huh? Ircha. It's from the Talmud. It's the poor people of your city first. And my response is, where's your city? Why isn't the world your city? Where is others? You know, the your city, the world, the planet. So what we have to do is really begin to go in the other direction, to expand, to notice where our love went and where it goes. And if we notice the contraction, like in the story I told at the beginning with my granddaughter, I noticed the contraction and then that it broke when there was empathy again. If we notice that when we're contracted and when we are when love is limited or love turns to anger because we want to control somebody that we have a relationship with and they don't do what we want, so we get angry. The anger is based on love, it's based on a need, it's based on maybe our fear of being challenged, our fear of being threatened by someone close to us, so we want to control them so that they don't interrupt with our comfort zone. Okay, ezor nochut. So we get angry. But if we notice this process happening, the anger arising from these places of need in us, we're already in the language of love. In a sense, we're already in touch with our heart. It's part of the process. We're already in touch. So we see the way the goodness in us has turned and become difficult, but we see it, we're with it. We are, in a way, sympathetic with our heart story, our heart language. It needs to be seen and not just to be automatic, be angry. As soon as we see the love turning to anger, or the relationship, or the threat, or the, you know, the way the dynamic of the emotions there, we're already in the language of the heart. And actually one of our greatest friends, although it doesn't seem like that, but our greatest friends is our vulnerability, our pigiyut or shavirut. It's one of our greatest friends, because if we are in touch with our vulnerability, we are not covering over, protecting, busy, as I say, maintaining with all our life this comfort zone. I must be protected, I must be comfortable, I must have things my way, I must do things the way I want, I must have it the way I need. And instead we are in touch with our vulnerability, and we suddenly find that life becomes really beautiful. Because yes, we're vulnerable, but we're on the edge all the time, of like the razor's edge. We are really there on the edge of life. We really are with life. We are vulnerable one minute, we're strong the next minute, we're loving. Then maybe the love turns and it's not so loving, but we're right there in the truth of the emotional life, which is, as I'm going to say in a minute, not just emotional life, it's also consciousness. So vulnerability actually leads to some bigness. If we can stay with our vulnerability, we become bigger people. But if we keep covering it over, we get shut in by our shirion, which is a prison also. And there's no accident that it's often called sweet vulnerability, which seems like, well, how can that be? But it is like that. If we're really okay with our vulnerability, it can open us, it can make us, in a way, much freer. And it can make the love flow more easily, because you don't have to defend yourself so much. You don't have to set up all the time. Life is not a battleground, a statecraft, because you've got nothing to defend. Your vulnerability is fine. There is a beautiful phrase, or some beautiful phrases in Buddhist teaching that which are the phrases that generate compassion. So some of the phrases, I don't think we're going to use them in this retreat so much, because we can't do everything in this retreat, but the phrases which are chanted in the Tibetan tradition and also other traditions from a text, I wrote them here. If I can find them. Life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. Life in any world has no protector. Life in any world has nothing of its own. Life in any world has to be left. You have to leave it. And you think, whoa, I can't say things like that. That's like, it means it all falls to pieces. Yes. But if we can stay with that, if we can just, it opens the heart of compassion, the heart of vulnerability, and from the heart of vulnerability comes a deep love and a deep compassionate being with all other beings in the world who are in the same place. It kind of opens up compassion for us. There is a poem I want to read which expresses very nicely the way difficulty or pain, if we are holding it and allowing it and being with it and watching it and in a way being kind to it or being honest with it, turns to its opposite. It turns to bigness of spirit, it turns to love, it turns to joy. Even the pain turns to joy when we are not fighting it, but allowing it and allowing the vulnerability. It's called a poem called There Is a Brokenness. There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken, a shatteredness, means again brokenness, out of which blooms what cannot be broken. There is a sorrow beyond all grief which leads to joy, and a fragility, Shavirud, out of which depth emerges strength. There is a hollow space too vast for words through which we pass with each loss, but out of whose darkness we are sanctified into being, sanctified, made holy into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound, whose rough edges cut the heart, but as we break open to the place inside which is unbreakable and whole. So we hear the music of the heart, even in that place of vulnerability, and especially in that place of vulnerability. But our practice and our journey is really towards unconditional love, towards the unconditional. And obviously one way to the unconditional is to meet the conditions, like I said, when we meet our defense or our resistance. If we meet the need to protect ourselves. But if we, one of the easiest places also to feel, to restore empathy is in the place of pain or difficulty. So that's why the compassion is so important in the Dharma, because difficulty is where we are sharing this place with all other difficult beings. When we're kind of beseda, in a way the beseda riut, everything's okay man, is in a way like making us again comfortable, which is fine. It's fine to be happy and joyful, and joy is also a connection with others, of course. But pain is a very powerful way in which we can reconnect. And I'm reflecting here about workshops we did some years ago with Israelis and Palestinians. And we used to spend 48 hours together. And a lot of that time we just spent being comfortable with each other, getting to know each other, communicating, chatting, talking about our lives and so on. But the heart of the process was 1 hour on the second day when we sat down eye to eye, an Israeli and a Palestinian, and we asked each other about our pain. And what really is going on, what's the difficulty in your life right now? And the heart is opened then. The honest expression of pain and difficulty opens the heart. Very quickly, very strongly, very immediately, you feel real empathic connection. It's beyond all ego, self, history, whatever. It's very strong. And the Israelis and Palestinians telling each other their pain, even for example the pain of asymmetry, the Palestinians, you know, in a way suffering more dramatically and having much more difficulty than Israelis who've been in Tel Aviv. But still, even the asymmetry was pain and held together as life doing it to us together. So something there was, I remember that as an example of how powerful meeting pain is to create connection. And compassion is a power that is very important in the Buddhist teaching. It's close to what we're doing. We're doing loving kindness or friendliness is, or empathy and compassion really go hand in hand. And it's powerful because we all have in us, just like we have empathy, we all have in us a natural urge, motivation from childhood to help others. I mean, the most kind of hard person will help a blind man to cross the road without thinking about it, because it doesn't threaten. It's clear, it's something that touching our good heart. We all have that good heart, all human beings have it. And not only human beings, animals too. And it's based on empathy, but it's actually even more powerful in a way. It's the real urge to help. And why we have it? Because we know suffering. And therefore we want others not to suffer. Because we know it. So from our own experience, we go out to compassion. Because we know what suffering is, we go out to compassion, which is why the vulnerability is important. If we are all feeling beseda and so on, then very often it's not really compassion, it's pity. Rachamim in Hebrew is instead of chemla, and means we're okay and we're giving something to Kaptan. And it's not real compassion. Compassion is that we are together vibrating of the heart. The heart is vibrating with the pain of the world. And so it's really taking you down to be humble. Because we know pain, then we can be compassionate to others' pain. And it needs us to extend it beyond the self, because the self will always block or stop the compassion from, like I said. And one of the ways we do this is to be have no preference. So we're going like, you know, this circle from self to family to, you know, out to friends to this. We're actually extending the circle so we can be compassionate to the stranger that we don't know, as Simi was guiding today. The stranger that we don't know, that opens a circle beyond me, my family, my group, my friends, my this, and that's it. And the rest. It's extending it to, and it needs us to be not self-centered about it, not conceptual, because otherwise we all have preferences. You know, compassion classically is for the tiger, as well as the Bambi that gets eaten by the tiger, as well as the deer, for, in an extreme case, for the, like the story I gave the other night, for the person torturing, as well as for the person who's being tortured. It has not, it's like rain that falls on everybody. So we, to develop compassion, we need to go there, we need to practice that. Yes, compassion on the tiger, as well as on the deer that's being eaten. But the tiger is doing what tigers do. And think of a Bhagavad Gita, the impossible situation that Arjuna was faced with, of having to fight and maybe kill his own tribe, his own relatives and so on, and Krishna representing the very big view, if you like, or consciousness, came and said, look, this is the way, you can't avoid things to be painful in life, just all you can do is spread your compassion and do what needs to be done in life. And sometimes you cannot avoid. Pain and suffering will be there for you and for others. So it's beyond, compassion is beyond, in a way, concepts of niceness or concepts of, you know, the mask. The English are very good at that. You know, doing lots of workshops in England, and I kept saying, you know, there was one workshop we were doing masks and painting masks, and they were all masks of niceness. And it's a problem. The compassion is not niceness. It's not being polite and. And there's something about the deepest practice of this that, like I said, it's maybe a bit abstract, but I want to read to you how, in the real ancient times, the Buddhist Sangha used to practice this. So, someone who, first of all, reduces the amount of greed and anger and confusion, and it says clearly mindful, totally mindful. So mindfulness is part of the practice. Clear comprehending is really seeing what goes on. He dwells, meaning stays in this state. It's not a 10-minute meditation. It's staying in the state. Spreading one quarter with a mind full of loving kindness. The second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. And then above, and then below. Across and everywhere. To every being, just as to himself. He dwells, he stays, spreading, pervading the entire world with a mind full of, imbued, means the mind is saturated with loving kindness. It's vast, Ein Sof, it's exalted. Exalted is nisgav. Is it has no measure. Just as a strong conch blower, you know the conch, the shell. In Hindu rituals, they blow a shell called a conch. Maybe you've been to those who've been to India will have seen it. It's a Brahministic tool, and it's a seashell, and they blow it. Woo! So just like a strong conch blower can easily send his signal to all the four quarters, so too, when the liberation of mind by loving kindness is developed and cultivated in this way, any limited karma that was done doesn't remain there, it doesn't persist. It's a kind of gives you a sense of what this practice kind of goes to. And it's radical. It firstly says that any limited karma is gone, meaning it really cuts and stops chain of difficulty, of ill will, of restriction, of anger, of small-mindedness, of all the things that bug us in our life. It just kind of wipes them out, and more than that, it's liberating, and it's non-conceptual. It doesn't even have any image in this one. No, not a person. It has no concept or no thought in it. It's totally under the thought level. It's totally in the level of some primal consciousness of a. In the Tibetan tradition, they have a word, bodhicitta, and bodhicitta, citta or cetta is mind, heart, same. And I think that's where we are with this. In fact, some of you, you know, if you feel like it tomorrow, tonight, whenever, imagine that you're here when you practice. Just put yourself here, not here. Just feel yourself here and do exactly the same practice you're doing, and see how that changes things. Mind, heart are one thing, and the awakening. Bodhicitta means body is pure consciousness, mind, heart, conscious, pure consciousness. And awakening is of is mind, heart. It's hard to distinguish, actually, in the end, whether it's mind that's doing it or heart that's doing it. There's something beyond boundary in both. And, you know, as I say, I want to keep referring to what we're doing here. We are in a way lifting up the heart, because we've already been practicing mind, we've been practicing mindfulness, we did it this retreat, we've done it in many retreats, and in our life there's a lot of encouragement to be wise, so we have that already in a sense, that movement. The heart is sometimes missing, and that's why this retreat is important, to bring up the heart energy, the heart language, the heart flow, the heart awakening. And then the heart and the mind, they feed each other. They're like one goes to the other. If we just like seeing, even the small story that I gave, seeing the difficulty of my granddaughter was seeing, and then the empathy came straight away. It needed me to see her situation, her pain of being afraid of dark. As soon as it was seen and understood and felt, and empathy, I could feel in some intuitive way, yes, I have been afraid too, and I'm with you. So the mind and the heart all go together, and the liberation of mind and the heart all go together. And in some way it brings us to truth. And, Dharma is truth, but it brings us to truth because we see things more in a total connected way. Instead, we see things as one. We see things as one flow of life. We see we're back sitting under the tree of life, and not the tree of good and bad. Good for me, bad for me. We're under the tree. There's a truth there, in which when we reduce the kind of control of me over these forces and powers in us, the wisdom and the heart, the bodhicitta. We reduce the control that we have on it, and the limits and the boundaries we put, then truth comes. It just turns up. You just live in truth, in a place of being, and not a place of our concepts about being. Yoffie. So, I'll finish with that, and maybe just a small. I read an article of Christopher, who wrote a beautiful article on love. And by the way, some things I'm saying are in articles that I wrote and in my website, just by the way. But there's a beautiful poem by an English poet called Auden, and then one small line of this poem says, how would we like it? He reflects on the stars don't care one bit about me. And that's how it starts, this poem. But then he said, how should we like it if the stars were to burn with a passion for us that we couldn't return? And if equal love, or if he calls it equal affection, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. It's a beautiful line, very touching. You know, if it cannot be that the stars love me and it's not equal, let the loving one be me. I will love the stars. I will love the light. Let it be me. And it's on us to keep the power of love just endlessly expanding unconditionally. Thank you. So we'll take a few moments of reflection.